Good evening and welcome to This Week in Football from the makers of Low Limit Football on the All In Sports Talk Network. I'm your host, Joe Uccello, and tonight joined by my co-host, Roberto Rojas, and from Football Tribe Japan, Dan Orlowitz, as we break down the Samurai Blue coming into the 2018 World Cup. Gentlemen, good evening and thanks for joining me tonight. Dan, I want to jump into this quickly and start off with you and focus on what makes you an expert in Japanese football and why you're so knowledgeable in the topic.
Hey, Joe. Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me. Well, I guess I should start with I've lived in Japan for just over 11 years now, and I've been following the J-League and Japanese football for about as long. I've got a bit of history before that. My first national team game was actually in 2005, but I've been writing and blogging and opinionating about the game here for quite some time now, I guess full time since about 2011. I've covered the national team at a number of international tournaments, World Cup qualifying, Asian Cup, East Asian Cup, all that fun stuff. And recently I've been doing a lot of match photography, J-League, national team, just about anything goes. And that's pretty much it.
You know, it's significant because Japan as a whole, you know, I think until 20 years ago, wasn't exactly a powerhouse in Asia. But you look back to the first time, I'm looking here to the history now of Japan. They qualified for the first ever World Cup in 1998 in France. They were obviously the debutants and they ended up losing all three of their games against Argentina, Croatia, and Jamaica. But then 2002, 4 years later, it was, I think, their most significant World Cup to date, where they co-hosted the 2002 World Cup with South Korea and ended up finishing in the round of 16. Looking at other history, 2006 got eliminated in the group stage. 2010, the only time they also made it out of the group stage was in the round of 16, where they got eliminated by Paraguay on penalties. And then 4 years ago, you go to Brazil, where they also got eliminated in the group stage. So it's been kind of, I would say, inconsistent for Japan. But I just want to jump in here, Dan, real quick. I mean, you know, the development of Japanese football 20 years ago has really been something of a huge change, I would say, in as a dominant force in Asia, when you're looking at a country where historically football or soccer isn't exactly the most strongest sport in this nation. So I just want to jump in real quick and ask, you know, what have you seen with the development, I guess, what people view the sport of football, soccer, now than it was, I would say, 20 or 25, 30 years ago?
Well, a quick history lesson. Japan's oldest competition is not, in fact, the Emperor's Cup, which is equivalent to England's FA Cup. The Emperor's Cup started in 1922, but in fact, 5 years earlier was the first ever All-Japan National High School Soccer Championship. That started in 1917, and in fact, just concluded its 96th edition this past Monday. So soccer, and I'll use soccer for purposes of... I always say I have to say soccer once every 10 times or they take away my passport. But the sport has a very rich history in Japan. Now, the country hasn't always been great at it, and it's always taken second or third fiddle to baseball and sumo, depending on the era. But they've been playing it for a very long time. Many of the dominant J-League clubs of today can trace their history back to company clubs, going back 50, 60 years ago. The J-League started in 1993, and that was really the beginning of Japanese soccer's push to legitimacy. So you have to really look at it from a 25-year period of development, and it was that push to put in a professional league and to raise the standard of play and to raise the standard of everything else, from training and facilities to academy coaching and development of youth players. That's what put Japan on the path to where they are at today. And if you want to really think about where they're at today, making the World Cup, reaching the tournament, is no longer the dream. It is the expectation. And now what the fans want is to get past the group stage and to get past the round of 16 and to go deeper. Are they capable of doing that? Well, that's another question. But Japan has really gotten into the point where you expect that they'll qualify for the World Cup, and that's a true testament of how quickly the nation has developed over the last 25, 30 years, really 40 years or so.
Now, Dan, I'd like to jump in here because, you know, what you said evokes an interesting thought. How can, as you're well aware, obviously in the United States here, we've had a little bit of a catastrophe, I would say, in terms of...
Oh, yeah.
What can things that have happened to Japan, the progression that Japan has demonstrated, what can other nations, especially the United States, learn from how they've gone about doing things?
I'd like to give a plug to my good friend, I believe your good friend, Tom Beyer, who's an amazingly knowledgeable technical youth coach, and he has done so much work in Japan and in China, and most recently started to really work in the U.S. For developing youth coaching and developing smart strategies, not for under-18s or under-15s, but you're talking about elementary school kids, giving them the ball, teaching them the technical skills that they need to succeed. I think we all agree that the U.S. has some of the greatest potential to succeed on the international stage, but you do need the foundation. You need to fix the academy systems. You need to fix how youth soccer is organized. You need to really take a deeper look at how coaching and how coaches are being developed and organized and trained and all that stuff. I think the MLS and the J-League, I consider them to be not necessarily siblings, but certainly close cousins. Mm-hmm. Both started in the early 90s, both sort of started with the goal of professionalizing soccer in their respective countries. And whereas the J-League has succeeded tremendously in developing players, the MLS has succeeded in marketing the game to a country that's not necessarily receptive to it. You know, you look at the work that the MLS has done in getting people to care about soccer in a country with four major sports already, and it's remarkable. It's wonderful. And I say to fans and to anyone who will listen here that the J-League needs to look at how the MLS promotes the game, but the MLS can look to the J-League and see how they're developing terrific players in their academies, and they're working together with the scholastic track. Just as many great players are coming out of high school and university as are coming out of J-League academies. And that balance is shifting slowly towards the academy system. But still, it's, you know, two sources of players is twice as good as one, really. And so there's a lot to be learned from both sides. But I always tell people that the J-League and the MLS are each one half of one of the best leagues in the world.
So let's fast forward now to qualification, something that the U.S. did not do. But looking at the group, which was Group B in qualification in Asia, they had to qualify with Saudi Arabia, Australia, UAE, Iraq, and Thailand. Three teams from this particular group in Asia all going to the World Cup. So tell me, you know, give us the highlights as to, you know, what they did and how they qualified moving through and into the 2018 World Cup.
Actually, if you don't mind, I sort of want to take a step back to not the final qualifying group, but the first qualifying group. You have to keep in mind that this cycle started in somewhat of a disaster for Japan because they got bounced out of the 2015 Asian Cup under then manager Javier Aguirre, who had replaced Alberto Zaccheroni following their 2014 World Cup exit. So Aguirre left after the Asian Cup, and then they brought in Vahid Halilhodžić, who did a really great job with Algeria in 2014. He came in looking to sort of revolutionize things, and what happened was in that first qualifier match against Singapore, I believe it was, they drew 0-0 at Saitama Stadium, the team's home ground, which had never before happened in World Cup qualifying. I don't think they'd ever drawn at home in a meaningful fixture. So it got off to a rocky start, but they did well in that group. They didn't really have too many difficult opponents. And then they were placed into this very difficult group, which had, as you mentioned, Australia, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, who are always pretty tricky. Keep mixing Iraq up with Syria in the previous round. And Thailand, who were really the Cinderella team of the group, and very strong. Full credit to Thailand. They're one of the leaders in Southeast Asia, and they've really improved by leaps and bounds. And they're going to be a team to watch going forward. So at face value, this was a pretty tight group from the start. You always sort of expected that it was going to be Japan, Australia, and Saudi Arabia duking it out for the top two spots. And I shot the opening match against UAE. Japan go up 1-0 and end up losing 2-1 at home. It was very embarrassing for the national team side, and they had to go away 2 days later They had to go away 4 or 5 days later to Bangkok and take on Thailand in a sold-out stadium, and that was an incredible atmosphere, and they won pretty comfortably, and from then on, things got better, and they did what they had to do. They won the games they needed to win, and they really capped it off with that 2-0 win against Australia on August 31st. So they did very well. You could say that they dominated the group, but it wasn't quite as easy as it should have been. And for the most part, Japan was never, they never looked quite as strong as they should have. And that's sort of the main issue going towards the World Cup, is that, yeah, they qualified, but are they good enough to make it happen when it counts? Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to go back to the coaching aspect before we run into the players, because I'm sure we're going to talk about, you know, whether the team is good enough moving forward. Player-wise, you look at the rosters, and they're fairly strong. Going back to the coaching, going back to Javier Aguirre, even though he coached 10 matches for the Japanese national team, he's one of the most successful coaches they've ever had. He only lost 2 matches and was sacked in 2015 for the because the Japanese Federation wanted to distance themselves from him as he was undergoing a match-fixing scandal investigation for Real Zaragoza, which was the club he had coached before he came over. They bring in Halley Hodes, who I believe you actually wrote an article recently stating that he's already planning his exit after the World Cup. So, you know, between Aguirre and that distraction, you come to Halley Hodes and you have another huge distraction, as this guy is almost like a lame duck manager at this point. Is the Japanese team able to focus past these distractions and onto the task at hand for the World Cup?
I mean, Aguirre, as far as Aguirre's match-fixing thing was concerned, I mean, that was a huge distraction, but let me make it clear. He was sacked because of the Asian Cup result. Losing to UAE in the quarterfinals in penalties, that was a devastating result. I was at the stadium for that match, and that was there were a lot of near-suicidal journalists at ANZ Stadium in Sydney that night. It was bad. It was embarrassing for the reigning Asian champions to go out like that. Aguirre was never really rated too highly during his tenure, and the match-fixing scandal didn't really help. And, you know, that's all I can really say about that. As far as Vahid is concerned, he has been fighting against the Japanese media since he arrived. The Japanese media never liked him. He instituted a lot of changes in how the team dealt with the media that they weren't a fan of. For example, I mean, this is getting a bit inside baseball here, but it used to be that the media would have basically unfettered access to all of the national team players after every training session. Vahid stepped in and he wanted to get rid of the mix zone entirely. The newspapers raised hell about that, and they eventually worked out a compromise where only 6 or 7 players would be available each day. And so in each pre-match cycle, you'd get to talk to each player once, and that was it. But the media didn't like that, of course, because it meant that they couldn't talk to Keisuke Honda or Shinji Kagawa every day, and those are basically the only two players who can sell newspapers in 2017-2018. So that sort of started the conflict. He is also, you know, as with his time in Algeria, you know, he's well known for these lectures and for sort of teaching the media how he thinks the team should play, and doing these very long press conference sermon, college lecture type things. And it's, there's definitely been a culture clash with him at the helm. So it's not surprising that he's already looking for an exit. It's tough for any foreign manager to survive in Japan. I'm not going to say for better or for worse, but it just, Japan as a whole, I mean, they need the, they need non-Japanese voices to tell them what they're missing, but they're not always willing to listen. They want managers who will come in and sort of bring the cultured international image, but still do it the Japanese way. And Vahid wasn't really willing to do that. And things improved. He got the job done. He qualified. But his legacy is going to be written in Russia.
Dan, I'm just going to jump in and then also go to Joe as well. Obviously, we're going to look at the nitty-gritty now. We look at the group. You know, Japan have been grouping Group H, and what really seems to be a really open group, I would say, for all the teams. Their draw in first with Poland, the team that really swept all of the European qualification. You got Senegal, the sensation of Africa, returning back to a World Cup for the first time since 2002. Ironically, that was co-hosted in Japan. And Colombia, a familiar foe that they faced 4 years ago. At the World Cup in Brazil, obviously, this in the order of the matches we got, they play Colombia first on the 19th, then they play Senegal on the 24th, and then they finish it up against Poland. Now, Dan, I'll just jump into you real quick, and I'll ask my co-host Joe as well. You know, obviously, this is an even group in itself. I think it would be really easy enough to get off the good start and look at an important match against Colombia. But for you, Dan, what do you think is the most important matchup for this Japanese side, or even the hardest?
I think it comes down to the Poland game. In general, the mood is that of cautious pessimism. I think if you asked most observers in Japan today, they'll say that Japan will either go no wins, one draw, two losses, maybe three losses, maybe two draws. I don't see a win against Colombia. I think that if they learn from the Ivory Coast game in 2014, they won't fold against Senegal. And really the question is, are Poland as good as their FIFA ranking says they are? I think if you lose against, you take the L against Colombia, you really, you play against Senegal smartly and beat them. Can you get a draw against Poland to go 1-1-1 and maybe sneak in as number two in the group? I think that's the angle. And that's what they're going to be looking for. I think that this group is it's very similar to the one that they had in 2014, with Senegal sort of replacing Ivory Coast and Poland replacing Greece and Colombia being Colombia. It's not the group of death that is Group F, but it's also not the group of life that is Group A.
Definitely. And Joe, I'll jump in real quick as well. Do you agree with Dan, or do you see like another matchup that I think is much more important for the Japanese side?
I echo the thoughts that they're going to really need to go 1-1-1 and kind of sneak through here. Obviously, we're pointing to that Senegal match as a match that is virtually a must-win for them in this group if they're going to have any hope. But I think if they're going to steal some, I think Poland, I don't think they're as good as the number 9 ranking that FIFA has put on them. But at the same time, I do think they are very, very good. I think they're a very strong team. And I think if they're going to steal anything, if the Japanese team is going to steal anything, they're going to have to steal it from Colombia. So that first match, if they can pick up any kind of result there, whether it be a win or a draw, I think the Senegal match becomes even more important. They really need to go into that Poland match without needing it. Because if they're gonna play on the front foot and be open to that counter, we all know about Robert Lewandowski and what he can do. And I think it's going to be very, very difficult to try and get a result against Poland. So I think for them, it's more on the front end. Start on the right foot. At least pick up a draw against Colombia. Really go all out against Senegal. And then, not necessarily need that last match. But if you pick up something from it, fantastic. If not, that's going to be okay, too. I think that's going to be the path for them. But obviously, I guess if you want to talk about a most important match, it's really going to be that Senegal match. Because if they don't get maximum points there, then the party's over for them.
If I can sort of chip in a bit more on the Colombia match, you have to look back to 2014 and think about how brutally embarrassing that dead rubber against Colombia was. So bad that Colombia used their last substitute to change goalkeepers. That was embarrassing for Japan. And, I mean, really, that whole tournament was embarrassing for Japan. The match against Greece was a shambles. And against Ivory Coast, they were doing incredibly well until Drogba came on and everyone wet their shorts. I agree with Joe that if they can get the draw against Colombia, anything can happen. If they get a win against Colombia, I refuse to even entertain the notion at risk of jinxing it. But I'll eat crow if it happens, and so will just about everyone else who makes a prediction.
A win against Colombia would be something magical for them. I mean, really magical. That's the kind of thing where they could go in to that Senegal match and win that match and basically qualify through without even worrying about Poland. That would be something pretty impressive, that's to say the least.
You have to put this campaign, if you're talking about the expectations game, their group in 2014 looked, and people were pretty confident heading in. Mm-hmm. People thought, okay, you can get a win against at least Ivory Coast, you can get a good result against Greece, and then against Colombia, whatever happens, happens. I think if Japan had gotten the two wins they should have gotten in those matches, it would be a much different story. And even if you want to go back to 2010 South Africa, the fans had little to no confidence in Takeshi Okada's squad and his abilities as coach. There were discussions of the fans having a walkout or a silent protest as close to the tournament as March or I believe April or May. Things were pretty grim, and then they went in and got amazing results against Denmark, Cameroon, and played pretty well against Netherlands. So, we can sort of make all these predictions, and obviously they're going to be grounded in reality, but you don't know what's going to happen until they play the game.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to move forward off the group and into the individual players and the team. Most of our listeners are more than familiar with Shinji Okazaki at Leicester and Shinji Kagawa at Dortmund, Yuto Nagatomo over at Inter. But one player that we haven't seen much because he has moved on from Europe into Mexico is Keisuke Honda. Previously at AC Milan. My question to you, Dan, is how was the move to Pachuca from Milan viewed by Japanese fans for Honda, on the team?
Weirdly. I'm going to name drop a player that I'm not sure if your listeners will know, but if you want to look at how Keisuke Honda has if you want to look at who Keisuke Honda has modeled his entire career after, it's Hidetoshi Nakata, who famously played in Perugia, he played for Roma, he had a short stint in the Premier League at the end of his career, but he was really the first David Beckham-esque Japanese player who was the wild child. He was the fashion plate. He was the rebel. He went to Europe and he kicked ass and took names. And that's what Honda has sort of been for this generation of players. But his time is running out. He's 31. He's not as fast as he used to be. He's not as good as he used to be. This, if he makes it to the squad, which isn't a guarantee these days, he's been left off the last couple of national team call-ups, at least for full internationals, because Vahid hasn't really been happy with his performance. And he's getting it done in Mexico. He's doing decently, and it's a challenge for him, and he took it on. But, you know, he's more of a sort of businessman, entrepreneur, player than he is a pure player. He just invested in Orange County SC, I believe it was. He's invested in a club somewhere in Africa. I can't remember exactly what country it is, but he bought a club there. He has something going on in Cambodia, I believe. So he's a businessman. He's got all this weird stuff going on. I shouldn't say weird. He's got soccer schools. He has all sorts of stuff, but he's sort of transitioning already from player to former player, current businessman, like a Beckham type. As for whether or not he'll play in Russia, that's really tough. I really couldn't answer that. And we sort of, and international fans who sort of casually know the national team are going to have to start doing some studying, because you guys may have to look at who's going to replace Honda in the squad, and that's somewhat of an open question.
Okay. Well, let's actually ask that question, because obviously the players that I've mentioned are, you know, somewhat household names. So in terms of a player to watch, give me a name, you know, even somebody that might replace Honda on this team, but give me a name that maybe we don't know about that could shine at this World Cup.
I'll give you the easiest name I can give you is Yosuke Ideguchi, central midfielder, 21. He just transferred to Leeds, and he's going to spend the rest of the season on loan at Cultural Leonesa in the Spanish second division. He is a bold midfielder, just great sense of the game, good leadership, good dribbling skills, wicked shot. If you look up his goal against Australia in August, just a rocket. And he is very good, and he's definitely a player with the capabilities to succeed in Europe. The question is whether or not his move to Europe came at the right time. A lot of people believe that he should have maybe waited, played this season, played this half season with Gamba Osaka in the J1, gone to the World Cup, and then gone to Leeds or wherever. So this is good. The question is, can he establish himself in Europe coming into the winter transfer market, which is, forgot to tell my wife that I was in a podcast. So the question is, can he integrate in the middle of winter, which is, you know, it's a tough period. You're not coming in over the summer. You don't have a lot of time to get integrated into the squad. But if anyone is going to line up next to Makoto Hasebe, who this will probably be his last World Cup with the captain's armband, it'll probably be Ideguchi. If you want to look at the attack, I would say Yu Kobayashi is a good player to look out for. It's a striker. He had a amazing year at Kawasaki Frontale last season. J-League MVP, J-League top scorer. He's 30 years old. He has never really gotten a great look internationally because he always seems to keep getting injured around the international breaks. But if his form stays up, and if he goes into the World Cup in good shape and with a lot of goals to his credit, then he could really turn heads.
Dan, I just want to jump in real quick now and look at predictions. Obviously, you know, for a team like Japan, you mentioned early on in the show, I think it's expected for them to always make the World Cup, but obviously, you look at that group, it's really interesting. But I kind of want to just jump in and talk about more of the team as a whole. Obviously, you know, we know familiar names like Shinji Kagawa, like Honda, you know, like Unai, who plays in Eibar, or Shigeo Okazaki, you know, Nagatomo plays in Inter. You know, I just want to ask, what kind of team do you think is going to be brought to this World Cup? You think it's going to be a mixture of J-leaguers and players playing abroad, or is it one basically a team dominated by European-based players? And also, you know, what should we look out for a country, I think, maybe for some that aren't familiar with the way Japan plays? You know, what's one thing to look for, and if so, maybe a predicted starting lineup for this team heading into Russia?
Well, I think it will end up being similar to the last couple of World Cups. It's going to be a solid mix of European and, I should say, internationally based players and J-leaguers. The J-League still has an incredible amount of talent, even though the talent drain is really getting younger and younger by the year. It used to be that if you were, say, 23, 24, 25, that's when a Japanese player is making the jump to Europe. Now it's 20, 21, 22. You look at Takuma Asano, who was signed by Arsenal, and now he's at Stuttgart. You look at Inui, who's 21. You look at you know, several other players who are making the jump at a younger age, and that's to their benefit because if you look at, you know, European players and you look at African players, they're going to Europe at an incredibly young age, and they're much more mature as players because since they were 18 or 19, they've been playing top-flight European soccer. As far as a starting lineup, I'll start quickly in, I guess, with goalkeeper. It's tough. Eiji Kawashima isn't as good as he used to be by a long shot, but unfortunately, Japan just really hasn't created any better goalkeepers. You have to assume if he gets the start, this is his last World Cup, it'll either be him or Shusaku Nishikawa of Urawa Reds, who had a fantastic performance in the AFC Champions League last season, if not domestically. At the back, you've got, you know, Nagatomo at left back. I think you'll have Yoshida and maybe Tomoaki Makino, who's my favorite villain. He's sort of my favorite. If you're into pro wrestling, he's the J-League's biggest heel. An amazing guy, and he's really improved as a player in the last couple of years. I mean, you know, he's 30, but you're never too young to improve. You're never too old to improve. But I think them at center back and then at right back, probably Hiroki Sakai, who's at Marseille. At midfield, I think Hasebe and probably Ideguchi, maybe Hotaru Yamaguchi from Seresso Osaka. You know, that's a bit of a toss-up. You've got, you know, three attacking midfielders. You know, I think Kagawa makes it. I think Kagawa makes it less so on his actual ability and more because Adidas aren't going to let him rot on the bench. If I'm being totally honest, I think Yuya Kubo, who's at Hent in the Belgian League, I think he makes it. He's, you know, he can play as a forward, he can play as sort of a winger, but he's just deadly. And, you know, if you're looking at midfielders, I think that, you know, you can play Yu Kobayashi on the wing, you can play, you know, it's tough, you know, you can play Mu Kanazaki out there. It's really tough because Japan Japan isn't really great at producing natural purebred strikers. Japan creates a lot of attacking midfielders and a lot of really good central midfielders. I'm talking about in the vein of Shunsuke Nakamura, Kengo Nakamura, Yasuhito Endo, who's more of a central midfielder, but a lot of number 10s. not so much, you know, number 11s or number 9s. So that's really been the challenge for Japan, is creating creating those natural strikers who are capable of getting 20 goals a season on a regular basis. And as striker, you know, who knows, probably Okazaki, could be Yuya Osako if his form picks up, could be Kenyu Sugimoto, could end up being Yu Kobayashi. It's really up for grabs. This is probably the most unsettled Japan's squad has been 6 months out in the last two or three tournaments. So, I mean, that's a rough, you know, barroom napkin guess as to who could be in the starting lineup. But between now and June, anything could happen.
No, of course, exactly. I think we don't know who will exactly make this World Cup. You know, one of them could miss it due to injury or some other personal problem. But I think if we're talking, I guess, now, I say, example, if the World Cup started tomorrow, you know, I think that team would definitely be better assembled. But just a follow-up, I mean, you know, you talk about all these great players that Japan has, you know, is there a name that, you know, we wouldn't be surprised of missing out, maybe a familiar name that we've been accustomed to?
Missing out, honestly, I think Honda is at the biggest risk of missing this World Cup. He took a very calculated risk in going to Pachuca. There's a very good chance it's going to backfire on him. If the squad were announced tomorrow, I would probably not put money on him making it. So he's definitely the most at risk to not make the tournament. Other than that, yeah, I mean, it's if you're going to look at the eligible Japanese players with 90-100 caps, I think everyone else is a lock. I think Nagatomo is a lock. I think Hasebe is a lock. Tagawa, as I said, is the face of the national team. Okazaki, I think you can't leave him out, and I don't think that Vahid will leave him out. And at goalkeeper, you know, if it isn't Kawashima, then it's going to be Nishikawa and probably Kosuke Nakamura, who just earned his international debut and did pretty well for Japan at the 2016 Rio Olympics. But he's widely considered the next star goalkeeper for the national team. So it's a question of when is Japan going to make the transition from the 2010-2011 squad to the next generation. It's tough for Asia because the World Cup happens in June and then the Asian Cup takes place the following January. So it's just difficult for a new coach to come in and figure out when to make that switch. Alberto Zaccheroni came in after the 2010 World Cup. He had his squad for Qatar 2011. They won the Asian Cup, and those were his men. That's who he took to qualifying. That's who he took to Brazil. And so the next coach of the national team is going to have to make a similar decision in not so much time. And he's going to have a lot to work with. But the question is, what's going to be left after Russia?
Now, Dan, looking forward, looking forward to the World Cup, what would be a successful World Cup for this Japanese team? What would you consider to be a success at this tournament?
Getting out of the group stage. I think that's the minimum that you can do and not get booed at the airport. 2014 dropped the bar pretty low. I think that if you were to have two straight group stage exits, that's going to provoke a bit of a national soul-searching crisis type thing. So I think they've got to get past the group stage somehow, or there's going to be heads rolling at JFA House. I think they bring out the guillotines if where they don't manage to do something to get into the knockout stage. Anything beyond that is gravy. I mean, they can go out penalties, they can get crushed by whoever it is they would get matched up with, I think Group G. So, you know, look, you take the 7-1 loss to Germany and you go home and everyone's still happy. But I don't think the media can support a second straight World Cup collapse. Japan sends, I think, that amongst the top four, Japan is in the top four in terms of the number of journalists they will send to the World Cup, and I think number two or number one in terms of the number of photographers they send to the World Cup. It's a pretty big industry, soccer media, and I don't think it can handle spending as much money as they will on another disappointment.
Okay. Now, looking forward in a perfect world for Japan and their 127 million people, what would the country look like bringing home the World Cup trophy?
Oh God, I can't even imagine. It would be the most significant accomplishment in the country's sporting history, period. That would be bigger than the 64 Olympics. It would be bigger than the men's team's bronze medal at the 68 Olympics. It would be bigger than all of the Asian Cup titles. It would be bigger than the Women's World Cup title. It would be a national holiday, I imagine. I mean, well, maybe not, because they're a bit stingy with national holidays here, but close enough. It would do so much, and I think that that's, as a journalist here, when you fear Japan exiting the World Cup in a disappointing way, what you fear is that interest in the domestic game will drop. Because honestly, the success of the national team is very closely tied to the success of the domestic league. If the national team does well, interest in the J League goes up. If the national team goes poorly, it dips. So, the J League is in a big state of transition. These last couple of years, they signed a $2 billion. They signed a $200 million broadcasting deal over the next 10 years. It's a lot of money that's going to bring in a lot for the league. And the question is, you know, whether or not the fans will stay tuned. We're talking about, you know, did DAZN pay $2 billion for a league that nobody is going to watch after June? That's the big question. I've talked about the national team now for about 40, 50 minutes now, but I could talk for hours on the sporting culture here and how it's not quite the sporting culture that you have in Europe or even in America, but it could be. And a World Cup would definitely push the country there. Yeah. But it's a pipe dream at this point. Sure. Really.
But it's something definitely worth dreaming about, that's for sure. So, Dan, on behalf of Rob, I want to thank you for joining us tonight to break down the Japanese national team as they embark on their journey to the 2018 World Cup. So for this week in football from the makers of Low Limit Football on the All In Sports Talk Network, I am Joe Uccello. Thanks for listening and good night.